Caught in the dark with a radio spark. Meet me where the most light falls. You're listening to Where the Most Light Falls with DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Hello, welcome to Where the Most Light Falls. On today's show, we'll listen to the beautiful album, Bliss, by Ulf Nomark. And I'll read poetry and a couple of nonfiction pieces. I'll also share some writing opportunities for you. As you're listening, I'd love to hear from you on Twitter at Tamara Miles SC or on Facebook at tamaramiles.poet. You can also visit my website, Sylvia's Daughter Says, at Wix.com. All right, let's have a little relaxing piano music. One of my goals on this show is to feature some emerging poets, or poets who are perhaps not as widely known as others. I call this the Lesser Known Poets Project. I'm a lesser known poet myself, and I find that I'm in good company. Recently, Raymond Sillard, editor of The Cynical, introduced me to a wonderful poet named Martina Rice Newberry, and I ordered her newest book called Never Completely Awake, available now at Deerbrook Editions. I found the poems deeply moving. Martina and I have been talking about the writing life with its anticipations and rejections, about how it is a fundamental part of our existence, just to go on writing. Martina is also the author of Where It Goes, Learning by Rote, Not Untrue and Not Unkind, and Running Like a Woman with Her Hair on Fire, collected poems. All of these are available from Amazon.com, and many of the poems are online. Martina was the winner of IE Magazine's Editor's Choice Poetry Chapbook Prize for 1998 for An Apparent Approachable Light. Today I'm going to read her poem, Hallways, from Never Completely Awake. "3:30 a.m. A child's voice somewhere down the hallways of our floor cries out and falls silent. I didn't know there were any children in this building. Even three floors up, headlights reach out to the space above our pillows, shimmer, disappear. Why would you come to me so late? Why not come when the sun is warm and golden and whiskey embraces ice in our dime store tumblers? Why not then? Out the window, down at the swimming pool, one apartment complex over, I see you, little brother. I call down, but you ignore me. Your long, skinny legs and arms float like an alien's limbs in low gravity. You do not wave to me, and I realize I am watching the dead. Our mother's last act took both of you, Cam. It was not cowardice that prepared your vodka and cough syrup over shaved ice. Her own needle and pills were not prepared with panic. She craved a oneness with you. She craved a bonding with her boy. I have craved that too, little brother. You are not here and haven't been, which doesn't mean I'm not your sister. Down by the pool, your shoulders hunch. You almost turn to look up at me, but no, not quite. And I know that in death you are indifferent to me, to what was done to you, to our mother's pathetic striving. Out of our house into the lush acreage of eternal memory lawns, and then back to my arms that will never hold you. I've been shouting, "Come back," into the dark all my life. Your fevered "no" rings out in the hallway, joins the voice of that other child, the one I didn't know was there. This poem reminds me of a story my father told me about when he was young and he traveled with his father to Oklahoma. They stayed at a relative's large boarding house, and Dad was stuck at the back of the place at the end of a long hallway. He felt scared. It was almost like the place was haunted, he said. Like Martina, who has written a memoir of her father, I'm writing a creative nonfiction book based on my father's life and also concerning family estrangement across 100 years of my ancestors. The book is called Same Moon Shining. The title comes from a letter that my grandfather Oscar wrote to my grandmother Dolly. Their last name was Moon. I'd like to see them again. Sometimes I imagine that I can go backward in time. One of my poems works with this idea of everything getting slow and time unwinding as if the sloth has seen her shadow. I'll read that for you now, and a little later in the show, I'll read from part one of Same Moon Shining. So this poem is called The Great Undoing. The sloth saw her shadow at the summer solstice. Thus the year trotted slowly backward, and what was shallow became deep. The dawn returned to bed with love unmade, and the silent alarm renounced the need for sleep. Newspapers withdrew their major headlines. The great wall unbuilt itself and put the thought of all new walls behind. People did not find themselves or even go outside to look. Pages flipped toward the covers of the books, and books slid unread on purpose off the shelves. All the stairs went in the wrong direction. Fear remembered hesitation. The fickle stars were shadows of their former selves. People sought a lower employment rate and asked only for new taxes. Days fell off of calendars. Earth sat in meditation on its axis. Fashion models dressed in cheap thrift store apparel and stood frozen with no makeup on the origami runway. Good girls and patient boys grew restless and turned feral and never gave their wild, wild hearts away. Oh, there's a wildness in us, isn't there? A restlessness. Some people follow it. People like John Muir, who wrote the extraordinary book Travels in Alaska. I enjoy reading from that book, and as an introduction to the next poem, I'm going to read from chapter 4, which is about the Stikine River. Gliding along the swift-flowing river, the views change with bewildering rapidity. Wonderful, too, are the changes dependent on the seasons and the weather. In spring, when the snow is melting fast, you enjoy the countless rejoicing waterfalls, the gentle breathing of warm winds, the colors of the young leaves and flowers when the bees are busy and wafts of fragrance are drifting hither and thither from miles of wild roses, clover, and honeysuckle. The swaths of birch and willow on the lower slopes, following the melting of the winter avalanche snowbanks. The bossy cumuli swelling in white and purple piles above the highest peaks. Gray rain clouds wreathing the outstanding brows and battlements of the walls. And the breaking forth of the sun after the rain. The shining of the leaves and streams and crystal architecture of the glaciers. The rising of fresh fragrance, the song of the happy birds, and the serene color grandeur of the morning and evening sky. In this series of poems I'm writing, which I call the Map Series, I attempt to recreate in poetry scenes like this one, to reduce the scene from this famous travel work to something manageable in a short poem. So the one I'll read for you now is called Map of John Muir's Travels in Alaska, Part 4, The Stikine River. Layered canyons, crystal water, gold dust spark infatuators lie sleepless with their vivid dreams. Trout tussle in a glacial stream. Climate change and a changing face. Pines and cottonwoods born from burn. Birch toward King Hemlock turning. Tamarack at the fire escape. And on he goes to Glenora. Fevered fascination in tow with what a man curious knows. 1,000 feet, the captain rests. Brave Muir, restless, can't stop climbing. Now you may have heard of this next poet. His name is Ted Kooser. He's a poet laureate of the United States from 2004 to 2006. And the poem I'd like to read is called In the Corner of Fields, from his collection called Flying at Night, poems 1965 to 1985. Something is calling to me from the corners of fields, where the leftover fence wire suns its loose coils, and stones thrown out of the furrow sleep in warm litters, where the gray faces of old no-hunting signs mutter into the wind, and dry horse tanks spout fountains of sunflowers, where a moth flutters in from the pasture, harried by sparrows, and alights on a post, so sure of its life that it peacefully opens its wings. The moth has a short life. Human life is a little longer, but not that much. You know, I like featuring poetry by my friends in That Curious Love of Green, an online creativity group. And today I'd like to feature one by Donna Mortensen. It's called Hoarfrost on Cattails, and it's a reflection on an aging, vulnerable parent. The poem is currently featured in Soapbox Literary Journal. Donna writes a wonderful blog as well. You can look her up on Facebook, Donna Mortensen. Hoarfrost on Cattails. The lake wears its mantle of skim ice. I hear a loon call, separated from its mate. My shoes press kidney shapes of smooth white onto blotted pale blades. Inside, Mom's weakened legs carry her, unsteady, to breakfast, lunch, dinner. A succession of half-eaten refrains, scored by lamb's wool slippers, their wearer too light to wear a path in the mauve institutional carpeting. In her room, cramped curled fingers twist a G-hook through yarn of the same mauve, unwinding the skein's smooth rounds into single crochets, no longer figuring eight into doubles and trebles, as even gauges give way to skipped stitches, missed turnings, lost patterns. The sun sinks over yellowed aspens outside her window. One golden leaf lifts petiole from bark and drifts its silence through air heavy with chill November mist. One sigh short of momentum, enough to send it homeward to ground. Instead, ensnared by silver-armed mesh, hugging it to the tree, denying its final rest on icy soil. And a poem from that Curious Love of Green member, Elsa Colley, called Lioness, which speaks to the formidable power and strength of a woman. Lioness. Watching and drinking in the whole scene to weigh it up, carefully prowling until she knows what to use precious energy on, circling in a slow decreasing arc towards the thing in eye line. It is not aware of her presence yet, so used is she to moving deliberately and nonchalantly that nothing even notices unless she wants to be seen, or they have crossed her path on the wrong side. Mainly, she does not roar. She is unassuming, quiet even. But a chord of fear is struck when they hear her angry battle cry. Notice for the first time her teeth. So much drank in slowly, like milkshake through a straw, chilling her insides little by little, a steady stream of ice till her hot anger overflowing slowly edges her toward her target. Watch her smile as she slithers in shadow. Kill her prey? No, not her. Breath like crystals of ice as she breathes over the fallen prey who smiles, unsure of why she looks different to him. And as her mouth covers his, she lets it all come forth, freezing his heart in his chest with the cold built up over forever. Now she is free. And the last one from the Curious Group today is by David Fenlon. A memory. A reflection on a place he'd like to go back to. It's called Where Was That Place? Where was that place? I can't quite remember it. It was was so, so good. Its sounds were golden, sealed and beholden. Do you remember it? Of course, it was real and you were caught, pure gold. You stood as standard in love's light, its line, in the love of love's light, remembering, amazing, that burning brightest night. Of course, it was real, and you were caught. Bright in its ending, as sun rose and moon's tides ended, your release, my catch. Stared down, was it, if I remember, looking up, deep down till again rising, sun glazed, still dazed in that new day, in beautiful true weight of a mind and our weight. Still remembering, together touching, together hot, last night's feeling lasting. Fired hard and true, that place, life fired, in night's furnace and love's burning truth. Its sun, dark's end, and one satisfied satellite, in changing room spaces embraced. So tried to tiredness and righteous happy ending, I must remember that place. Do you? It's nice to have a memory of a good place to go to, a good company. This next poem I'd like to dedicate to my friend, Tammy Altizer. She's a bartender at Pam's Front Porch here in Columbia, South Carolina, on Park Lane Road. I've spent many an afternoon as the strange woman reading on the porch. Who brings a book to a bar? People say as they walk by. I do, I say, and go on reading. If you're ever in town, drop by Pam's and say hello and have a cocktail. This poem's called Bitters. I do like to toss a little bitters in my drink. Apothecary in a glass, said to give the cocktail class. Mysterious adult botanicals, a portfolio of flavor. They will do your drink and mine a medicinal favor. Secret herb and spice steeped, gentian wide and wormwood deep. Two shakes for sour or bittersweet appeal. A taste to growl at spirit hounds we meet, quiet them and bid them heal. Quinine for mosquito days of summer minus sleeves, on lunch hour liberty, busy streets. They frame the aperitif in medieval orange or in peach, boost the liquor's speech and shine its shoes. They drain all the strains of fevered politics from the daily news. That poem was written in response to an international contest sponsored by a poetry venue called O'Beale in Cork, Ireland. The contest involves using 5 specified words within a poem of 40 lines or so. I'm going to read you another one of those poems, which was selected as a finalist in the 2017 competition. It's a true story. The poem is called Minor Deities. We were at Hilton Head. I'd heard the resident blue heron at our rented townhouse pond was choking on a rope and would almost surely die. A vet had been summoned. I began to pray to provoke a distant God into relinquishing his insufferable hold on life and death for this 1 hour, to spare the great bird. In regular life, in the comings and goings, I wear a face of proud intellectualism, make fun of some of the absurdities of religion, say all paths the same to whatever glory, whatever neoclassic nirvana we may find at the end. But for the minor god knotted up in the throat outside, I turned to my old ways and muddled through a murky intercession. I do not know how it turned out. We left the place that day before I learned for sure whether either god would live on. The required words for that poem were heron, muddle, provoke, minor, and where. If you'd like to enter that contest, it goes all year long from April to about November, and you can find it at O'Bell. It's O'Bell at O'Bell.com. Now I'd like to read a poem by a friend and university teacher in Nepal. His name is Bam Dev Sharma. He posted this poem on my Facebook page the other day, and I just thought it was fabulous. It's called Whoever Is to Decide. My father asked me to be a rock, and my mother asked to be a river. I remained indecisive as what would be a better choice. I feared rivers have meandering roots, and rocks too undergo metamorphosis. But I made my conjecture. My flesh is my rock, and my blood is river. I fail to pay promises that my parents may have cherished. I now realize I am both rock and river. I flow like a river in my dream, through the meandering roots, under the crevices of land. Neither do I eschew rocky self in me, which breaks me into boulder and silt, sprawling over the landscapes. I develop a sense of vague fear, not to lose my rocky and fluid self. I am clasped by a confounding puzzle. What actually I am, whether rock or river? So I let the question open. Whoever is to decide? This question about who we are, it comes to us on moonlit nights. I'm thinking of a poem by a young woman named Haley Cotton, whom I met at the Suwannee Writers Conference last summer. Haley is a teacher at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where I got my master's degree. She's a wonderful person. I'm going to read her poem called Truck Bed Nights. It's got a little quote by a mud puppy with it. The quote is, "The moon is God's contact lens." Our backs against the cab, tree lines V to the vanishing point, and I ride its furrow backward through the night. Was this the way we did it before? Fishtailing down an old logging road, tossed with broken lines of Loretta lyrics and crescent moon truths. I'd like to think we held a fuller moon, or perhaps an emptier beer. Now in this dark, elm, oak, pine, and sycamore all look the same, blurring their edges, reshaping their names. We lock hands at the wrist and take the ruts skin to skin. And the brake lights burn, our bodies disappear, leaving just the curve of eyelashes and the lips' vermilion borders. Haley's moon poem is a good introduction to the short reading from my creative nonfiction book, Same Moon Shining. If you enjoy this reading and like to hear more, or would like to share any other responses to what I've presented on the show today, will you let me know by writing me at TamaraMilesSC@gmail.com or on Twitter or Facebook? You can also visit my website, Sylvia's Daughter Says, at Wix.com and leave a comment. Same Moon Shining, Part 1, Crossing the Street. In the 1920s, a woman named Florence Mallory Shelton had a massive heart attack in the middle of the street where she lived in Oklahoma. She and her family were moving from a house on one side of the street to another one just across the way. She left behind several children, including Edwin and William, who were twins, Lucille, Albert, Marie, and Clinton, the eldest. In the care of a father who was apparently an alcoholic and regularly absent, William Sr. So when he was able, at about 16, Clinton started working at various jobs until he was able to provide secure housing for himself, and then he began bringing his brothers and sisters over one at a time to live with him. He sent them to school and cared for them. At 21, he married a young woman named Marie. At 22, he went to work for Sheffield Steel in Kansas City as a crane operator. And he remained in that position for the next 33 years until he retired, even though he lost his leg in a workplace accident. On the side, Clinton worked at Fine Leather Craft, making beautifully carved purses, business cases, and gun scabbards, among other things. He and Marie were divorced within a few years in 1930, and she at some point went with their son to live in New Jersey. It would be the first of many estrangements to come. In 1932, he married Alma Cox from Arkansas, and although they tried for 10 years, they could not have a child together. And so in 1942, they adopted my father from a temporary home for babies called the Kansas City Cradle. They named him Thomas Ashley Shelton, and the story of this boy became in time the beginnings of my own story. It is a story of loving and leaving, of wondering where a loved one is and if he or she is happy or sad or missing home there in that mysterious other place so far away from knowing, where, nevertheless, the same moon is shining. I'll have more of that on a future show. Now, I've told you that I'll be reading from different literary journals, and today I'd like to feature the Harpoon Review, which is edited by Gary Lovely and Jack C. Buck. The first poem from the Harpoon Review is called Riot Cherubs Roar by Alex Ivey. Alex is a writer of short stories, novels, plays, poetry, and awesome love letters. He is a New York native, currently on loan to California. His work will be appearing in Drunk Monkeys this summer also. Riot Cherubs Roar. Riot Cherubs Roar, Screamer on the balcony, the boy who will glide above the bee sting, outwit the fox, outbreak their hearts, who will wheel them back together for the first time, Outlaster, Master Blaster, who will scream and laugh and blast off, he who hangs in the sky, overlord of his mother's garden, counter outer, first round shouter, body rocker, microphone shocker, who tells of not one, not two, but 300 Arabian Nights. The boy who beat Luke Skywalker in a lightsaber fight. Riot cherubs roar. At daybreak, break the barriers of sound, our eternal shackle of gravity. At daybreak, soar from your father's arms, armed as newborn predators, as a man with nothing to lose. Come close to the point where night becomes day, where our bodies explode and return to heaven's arms. Blast us to dust as atomic mist, through the eternal barrier of our people, and you lead us between the raindrops. Riot cherubs, roar, roar for the sky to crash down upon us. Bring it down like a plaything, loved one. Bring it down and set us free to riot through this universe. Roar for the bee who can't ride these warm currents like you do. Out with them all. Riot cherubs, roar. Oh, that poem inspires me. The second poem from the Harpoon Review that I'd like to share is The Calm Eye Passes Over by Jennifer Moore. Jennifer is the author of The Veronica Maneuver, selected as Editor's Choice for the 2015 Akron Series in Poetry, and a forthcoming chapbook, Imaginary Weather, from Hermeneutic Chaos Press. Her poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Diagram, Crazy Horse, Best New Poets, the Cincinnati Review, and elsewhere. The recipient of fellowships from ArtSmith and the Gentle Arts Foundation, she is an assistant professor of creative writing at Ohio Northern University and lives in Bowling Green, Ohio. The calm eye passes over. What begins in a landscape, what begins with the land, a field of hayseed. Here is a field, here is a horse, her neck bent down, a neck that scatters the birds away. There's a form of incomplete mourning, a storm with an eye wall, but no eye. At the blindest hour of night, a woman drags a box to the forest, hurling plate after plate against the young trees. What a loss comes to mean, shattered plates in the woods. One after one, the night blind trees, a very young widow, the porcelain smashed. A shattered plate in the woods, a very human raindrop. A human sorrow, some human rain. I love you, but I can't give you anything. Like something that doesn't exist. A plate, then its shards in the woods. A plate, then the underside of a word. Try to convince me the hammer loves the egg. Try to convince me the eye of the storm is open, that the eye of the storm that sees you will bypass the cowering form where my grief meets your grief. A clear eye, a filled eye, a ragged eye. Grief against the morning for the sorrow at the hammer. The eye wall meets the forest, a mile wide eye, a pinhole eye. While the calm eye passes, my grief meets your grief. I and an eye, unstable eye. The calm eye passes over in a field of hayseed. A very human word. The calm eye passes over. Have you ever felt like taking a stack of china plates and smashing them against the wall? Because you were grieving or you were angry? Sometimes we need a way to get back to the dock, to the mooring place. where we feel safe again. I've been sharing writing prompts based on visual images recently on Twitter and on my Facebook poetry page. And one of the prompts featured a striking photograph of a boat, a small fishing boat tied to the dock. I was tickled when a poet and author named Mark Gordon responded to the prompt with a delightful poem called Rowboat. Here's a brief introduction to Mark from his website. I was born in the middle of World War II and grew up in the seaport city of Halifax, Nova Scotia. It wasn't until years later, when I moved inland to Montreal and Toronto, that I realized what a strong effect the ocean had on my view of the world. It was always nearby, immense and uncontrollable, breathing billows of fog and the scent of brine over the town. I didn't write poems as a child, but I remember sitting on my father's knee as he read me the poetry of Shelley and Keats. His poem's called Rowboat. A battered rowboat sits in an ocean inlet or a lake. It looks burnt by the sun, its paint peeling. It reminds me of certain people when they reach a certain age, skin leathery, eyes dull. When the rowboat begins, freshly built, its oarlocks sparkling, it's ready to take on the waves. Whoever sits in it bends his back to see where it can go before it breaks. Now it's a relic, fit for a museum of nostalgia, taking you back to those days when you first learned to row, when you first realized how deep the ocean was, how it could pull you beyond your height, its dreaded undertow. Now it reminds you of those days that you spent at the oars, measuring your muscles against the waves, those mountains that defied you. Let it rest now, this heap of wood, charred by the sun. Let it sit at the dock, the waves bobbing it at their will, no one to understand what it's done but those of like age and experience. Time teaches us, doesn't it? Let me give you a writing assignment. Grab a pen and a piece of paper and see what you can do with this question. I'll actually give you a couple of questions. When you've answered one or both of them, send it to me on Twitter or Facebook or by email so I can consider it for reading on the air next time. Okay, are you ready? The prompt is, do you believe it is possible that there is a parallel universe that exists alongside ours, one in which you and I have lived different lives? Do you believe in time travel? If you could travel through time, where would you go and what would you do? You may remember that on the last show, I introduced a piece of writing by Raymond Sillard called The Tangled Gate. Well, in his mysterious story, Labyrinthine, which he likes to call fiction, recently published in The Cynical, he does a little interdimensional travel. I'm just going to feature a short section related to his search for the great cavern beneath the Tangled Gate. I like this part because it reminds me of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's vision of Kubla Khan. I look for the fuzzy cotton candy entrance up through the floor. From the tree I climbed up from the great cavern that I thought was below the Tangled Gate. Don't see it, just the usual dark floor. I want to get back down there, but don't know how. So I nod to Mr. Bob, the barman, and I leave the bar, right through the door onto the street. I walk down the street, not long till I come to the Noah Hotel. Decide to walk in. No revolving doors, just an intricately carved oak set of doors, tinged green and gold. Push into the entirely mirrored lobby. It's glaring and dizzying. I nearly fall, kneeling before it all. On whim, I close my eyes, stand and start to walk forward through the lobby, sniffing and humming as I go. Stumble a bit, but something starts to emerge. Shapes, colors, but it's not the lobby that one would see with eyes opened. It's the cavern. How? I open my eyes and find I'm in a hotel hallway. Not surprising. Close eyes and I'm surrounded by creatures looking up at me, sniffing. Oh, it's a mysterious business, the mind of an artist and a writer, the places he goes. I'm thinking now of other places, places that are painted. For example, Vincent van Gogh's Sower with Setting Sun. I've written poetry in response to paintings, as many people have. This type of poetry is called ekphrasis. And I'd like to read the one that I wrote in response to Sower with Setting Sun. With the last few silent seeds sown in late sun, the sower, brow beaded in sweat, heeds dusk. Prays that where the dark seeds grow, they grow free from greedy weeds, and he grows free from whispered worries yet, and deeds that need doing. At quickened speed, he daydreams of a woman who knows his days are thorny, and thinks to meet thorns means one may someday greet the roses, but roses do not grow in these rows. No, he knows this. They grow in finely sown rows, he supposes, where roses grown by fancy gardeners grow, and he no fancy gardener, but a sower of dark seeds. Dark, burgeoning seeds that feed the ones who read by lamplight stories of secret gardens. Into those gardens she leads, the scented woman he knows, and even he who can't read reads well enough the woman and her needs. He vows to read her more closely than she dreams a man with dirt-stained hands can, and bring roses in those hands from the garden he has planned. It is no secret garden. It grows the way his heart grows, unthwarted, in broken ground, hardy, not temperamental, waiting only on the sun to come, untroubled by weeds. Ever go to poetry readings? Public poetry readings. I've got a little essay called Strangers at Poetry Readings about the experience. Starting with a particular experience of mine when I was in Belfast last year. I was alone at a hotel when I received an invitation to attend a poetry reading there. In Belfast. The invitation came via Paul Casey, the director of O'Beale, a poetry venue in Cork at the southern end of Ireland. He had kindly routed me to Belfast to hear Adam Crothers, a Northern Irish poet whose debut book of poetry had come out in January. I made my way to the desk to ask the concierge to call a taxi for me, and there I ran into a young woman named Anastasia, about my daughter's age, who was asking the concierge what kind of sights and sounds she might find in the city. I mentioned that I was going to a poetry reading, and she was welcome to come along. To my surprise, she did. On the way over in the taxi, she said, "I've never been to a poetry reading." And I thought, it's a good thing the reading's in a bar, so she can at least enjoy a drink if she doesn't like the poetry. However, it turned out that she was fascinated by what she witnessed. We stayed until the reading was complete and then hopped back into a taxi to search for a late night dinner. Stopping at an ATM, we came upon a homeless man clutching a bottle of vodka. When he asked if I had any change, I astonished myself by saying, "Yes, I'll trade you some change for a poem." At this, the man laughed. What a beautiful face and laughter there in the dark. And gave me not one, but two delightful limericks in a personal poetry reading on the dark streets of that once and still in some ways troubled city of Belfast. I was truly grateful. What makes us enjoy hearing strangers or even people we know well read us their innermost private thoughts, presented in various images and rhythms and in their unique voices? Why do we go to poetry readings? Why do we read our own poetry out loud before other people, risking any number of outcomes? People may not show up, and if they do, they may not listen. They may talk over us as we read. They may get up and leave, fail to understand, ridicule, or just not connect with us personally. On the other hand, if we are lucky, someone in the room listens deeply, smiles and nods and stays. And of course, now people only have to turn on their laptops to watch or listen to a poetry reading. And that is in some ways an entirely different experience. A person voluntarily listening to poetry at home, perhaps while doing other tasks, can stumble onto what he or she really enjoys in poems. No pressure, no expectations for a response. He or she can listen to several different readers in different locations around the world. I organized a 12-hour online poetry reading last year. Since I collected, organized, and delivered many of the materials, as well as emceed them, it was an invigorating but exhausting experience. Other friends and community members joined in. And in the gaps when no one volunteered to share recordings, I chose from the myriad available online readings, from famous celebrities to famous living and dead poets, from slam poetry to spoken word to interpretations of Gerard Manley Hopkins' glorious works. My Northern Irish friend Mark Burns shared his canvas and paper poem, describing what he and all poets are made of. And that brings me back to the Belfast memory, to Adam Crothers reading from his dark, brave poems in a loft bar, to me sharing my table with Anastasia, a cabin crew world traveler whom I had just brought to her first of what I hope are many more of her listenings. For this is what the readings are for, they're for listening. We can lean in, lean back, look up, close our eyes and participate in the poem's rhythms, the rise and fall of breath and time, the lyrical measure of word movement. Let us listen fully to the poet who gives himself or herself away to word and silence, to eyes and ears that seek to understand. I've got time for a couple more poems. So drawing from my bag, I'm going to select another summer poem. It's called When My Lover's Eyes Flash, because this is the season of lightning bugs. And wherever you find lightning bugs, you find a little romance. It's a peculiar love poem. When my lover's eyes flash, in my hand a jar of lightning, Lampyridae beetles, small catalytic machines whose larvae emit light, summer climate bioluminescence, color tuning, green and yellow, caution, go, a luciferous flashlight to attract and to repel, insect evolution, excitation energy, kinetics. And in a rare event, male synchronous fireflies and blue ghost fireflies will blink in unison 6 to 8 flashes and then stay dark for several seconds, making a kind of laser light show across a forest. Laser physics uses the term speckle to refer to a pattern made by a beam of light reflected on a surface such as paper. An optical interference, spectral, an illuminated spot, dot, or dash, unwanted. But for the speckle-winged rangeland grasshopper, a method of concealment. Its wings speckled dark, its underside pale yellow-green, translucent. Grasshoppers, too, know how to fly when they need to. When you are reaching out a hand to try and catch them, try to hold them. Did you know holding a firefly will eventually make it stop glowing? Many beautiful things don't like to be held too tightly. Well, I think it's about time to round things up. I'm going to do one more quick poem and then we'll play our tune that we end the show with. This one's called Night Swim. Also, subtitled The Other Woman. I swim in the dark. Underwater, my doppelganger greets me, her hair a loose coil of sea snakes. Eyes wide, purposeful, long neck turning as she surveys the azurite landscape, its subtle energies, and tells me her name in a foreign language. It sounds like daring. The taste of her tongue soft on mine is honeysuckle copper. Poseidon's wife, Amphitrite, and the old sea god, apoplectic, cannot find her. Swept along, I lose my other name. It does not follow me. Friends, I've had a wonderful time with you. I'll be back in September with another show. I hope you'll join me then, and feel free to come back and listen to the archives and send me a note anytime. Caught in the dark with a radio spark. Meet me where the most light falls. You've been listening to Where the Most Light Falls with DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. I borrowed the music for this theme song from purpleplanet.com, free background music. And the words are mine. Song's called Caught in the Dark. I'll meet you back here next time.